Welcome to the Free to Choose Media Podcast. Today's podcast is titled Avoiding the Coming Generational Storm. Recorded in 2006, Dennis McQuiston, former clinical professor of corporate governance and executive director of the Institute for Excellence in Corporate Governance at the University of Texas at Dallas, continues his conversation with syndicated financial columnist Scott Burns, co-author of the book The Coming Generational Storm, and Peter G. Peterson, co-founder of the Blackstone Group, about America's fiscal challenges, particularly related to entitlement programs and government debt. We hope you enjoy today's episode, and don't forget to subscribe to the Free to Choose Media Podcast.
You know, I'm part one of this two-part series discussing what our generation has done financially to future ones. My guest, Scott Burns, and I laid out the problems. Now, you can see part one on our website at www.frtv.org. Direct federal debt of almost $9 trillion and over $50 trillion in promises for Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid, all of which could lead to your and my kids and grandkids paying twice as much in taxes as we do. Yes, twice as much. But here's the good news. Scott Burns and his co-author Larry Kotlikoff have solutions, so let's get to them. Scott, I am absolutely certain that you have solutions to this problem, but before I get you to put them up, I want to go over graphic number four one more time. We did this on the last program, but I want to bring that viewer up to speed, is that we were looking at possibly up to $83.9 trillion in unfunded liabilities of Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid. That doesn't even include the direct debt of $9 trillion, Scott. And then I want to look at graphic number seven, which is one we have not looked at yet. I'd like you to explain that graphic to us, if you will.
Well, that's an examination of the Social Security Trust Fund cash position, excluding interest. See, the interest is accrued. So when you get the little letter from Social Security that they warn you there's going to be a problem in 2040, the cash crunch hits a lot earlier. And that comes from a table in the Social Security Trust Fund report, in the Social Security Trustees report, and it shows that if we have high costs, the cash crunch will hit around 2010. Notice that that's not 2040, that's 2010, that's 4 years from now.
Yes.
If we have intermediate costs, which is the cost they use as their real benchmark, it happens around 2014. That's when the cash coming in from the employment tax is exceeded by the benefits going out for Social Security and Medicare.
Okay, I'm going to look at graphic number five. Yours and my friends at the Wall Street Journal, I think, typically do a pretty good job of figuring things out on the editorial page. However, this is what, and I suspect Steve Moore wrote this, I don't know, but the biggest false assumption, however, is that the current level of benefits will ever be paid. They won't. There's a key legal point here. Entitlement benefits are not a contractual government obligation in the sense that a T-bond is. And so what they were saying last year, Scott, was this, is that people like you and I and Kotlikoff and Pete Peterson and all who are concerned about this coming generational storm, there's no reason to be concerned because we simply are really not obligated to pay Social Security and Medicare. How would you respond to that?
I'd tell them to talk to a few Medicare recipients. Or, as you mentioned earlier, the fans of Dan Rostenkowski, who chased him when the Medicare catastrophic tax was passed. Seniors chased him, and he beat up on his car.
You're talking about former Congressman
Yes.
Dan Rostenkowski.
Yes, long ago, back in the 80s.
And so when a small tax was put on those folks, they beat up a congressman and beat up his car. So are you saying that we might, with the AARP and their 35 million members, find ourselves having one heck of a problem deciding if these benefits are not going to be paid?
I think we would. AARP, if you go onto their website, they already are campaigning to reduce payments to doctors. And I think what we're going to wind up with is the Soviet department store problem. Plenty of goods displayed, but none available for purchase.
Interesting. Well, so what is one of your solutions? Should we raise taxes?
Well, there's the grandchild solution, which comes up first, and that is a heavy pillow. Unfortunately, it will be on you and me, and that's a way to solve the problem.
You know, what do you mean by that, Scott?
Well, if people don't live as long, if people don't have their last year of medical expenses, the medical expenses will go down. The former Soviet Union has solved the problem of Social Security simply by having a life expectancy of 58 years. No one's there to collect the benefits.
Well,
that's a kind of draconian solution. I don't think a lot of people would be enthusiastic about.
Some sort of H1V bird virus or something like that. We could have those things happen. Yeah, but that's not a solution you're recommending.
That's not a positive solution. It doesn't deal with our success as a society. That's what we really have to do, face the cost of success.
All right. Yes, ma'am.
Yes, I worked in the home healthcare industry in this country for nearly 30 years. My question is, how do you get people to ask less of the medical community or the medical treatments at end of life? How do we take responsibility for our own lives and take good care of our health and invest more in our own future instead of looking to the public?
What a great question that is, Scott.
I think there are a lot of moves going in that direction. Unfortunately, they are often overridden by the practices of doctors. It's much easier for a doctor in a situation of duress to say, well, we'll try another treatment, when in fact, something close to hospice care really should be recommended. But for the doctor to recommend that, he has to go on the hot seat and face the relatives who may not be ready to make that decision. There are moves which engage people to make their own decisions, and they're discussed in the book, where it's been found that if people are truly engaged and treated as intelligent individuals and given good information, they often make more conservative treatment decisions. They don't automatically opt for the most expensive treatment.
Let me just to piggyback on your question, your great question, by telling you about who one of my favorite presidents was. And Scott, even you weren't alive when he was president. His name is Grover Cleveland. Perhaps you've heard of him. And Grover Cleveland said this in 1887. So let's see graphic number 8. I'll tell you what Grover Cleveland said. He says, I can find no warrant for such an appropriation in the Constitution, and I do not believe that the power and duty of the general government ought to be extended to the relief of individual suffering, which is in no manner properly related to the public service or benefit. A prevalent tendency to disregard the limited mission of this power and duty should, I think, be steadily resisted, to the end that the lesson should be constantly enforced that though the people support the government, the government should not support the people. Now, this was what President Cleveland said in vetoing a bill to give $10,000 to Texas farmers struggling with a drought. And that was 1887. Now, let me tell you something else about Grover Cleveland. He vetoed in his first term 414 bills. How many bills has the W vetoed so far, Scott?
None that I know of.
None. He vetoed in his second term 170. Far more than all the previous 21 presidents combined. He said, I ought to have a monument over me when I die, not for anything I have done, but for the foolishness I have put a stop to. Heaven forbid, you know? What a guy. Do we need this guy or what? Now, Scott, as a solution, how do you either fix or put a stop to Medicare and Social Security, which are the two big things other than the direct debt that are going to kill us in the future? What do you do specifically?
Well, who is the you? If we go back to government, it's a really long shot. We have to ask them to start to privatize Social Security, not necessarily in individual accounts like a 401k plan, but in broad index accounts. That would do some good for Social Security. The bigger issue is Medicare, and there, if we had a voucher system, we could return decision-making to individuals, and there might be better decision-making. Again, I think that's a long shot. What I would like to see is actually kind of a public trial of peacetime criminals. Those in 1983 who voted for the current reform of Social Security who are still in office. I'd really like to see a political move to take every one of them out. As elected officials.
Mm-hmm. Certainly glad you clarified that, yeah. Scott. Exactly. Come up here, Alan. This is one of the premier financial planners in the country and teachers and all those other things. Alan,
and a good friend of Scott Burns.
Have a shot at
it. Scott, you mentioned before that the deficit is growing. The problem or question I have has to do with the fact that the U.S. economy, as part of the world economy, is losing its preeminence, and a number of other countries are coming to power and play, where you're going to start to see more goods being shipped and sold overseas because there's money overseas now, growing middle class, a growing upper class. As we start increasing the trade surplus instead of the deficit, won't some of that surplus offset the deficit you're discussing relative to Social Security and the impact that that's going to have?
I think the relative difference in the numbers is you're dealing with the formal obligations of the United States government and the trade figures, which are relatively small compared to the increase in the informal figures, which are the ones that the earlier quote was talking about. They aren't funded debt, mm-hmm. but they are promises.
That's correct.
And I think those figures are vastly larger than anything that would be done with trade. And I'm not so certain that our trade is going to increase. Suppose, for instance, that the hegemony we have on design mm-hmm. starts to disappear. Start looking in fashions. You start seeing more and more Asian-oriented fashions. What happens when New York no longer has a design control? What happens when other things start moving out because, you know, China educates more people in a year than we do, simply because they have a vastly larger population? That's when I think things really start to get ugly relative to our obligations. And that's when all the dollars that are out there, we've got, I think, $700 billion in circulation, half of it's not in this country.
Well, that's another very good point. What happens if the dollars aren't exported? What if Japan and other countries that are buying our dollars say, no, we'd rather buy euros, we'd rather buy something else?
Well,
that's going to exacerbate the position.
When they start, this is all a game of the emperor with no clothes. The problem with, you know, we can talk about worrying about other governments doing that, and the Russians are buying less in dollars now. They're diversifying. The Chinese are talking about diversifying. Mm-hmm. I think there are a couple other countries that are starting to do it. But when push comes to shove, we're still in better shape than most countries, demographically and in terms of the generational obligations. We're way better off than Europe.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And unfortunately, that's exactly right. John, you had something you wanted to say to Scott, did you?
I was just asking how much demographics is driving this problem, and is there a solution by opening up the borders?
Demographics is the driver. The demographics of greater life expectancy and the absolute demographics of the baby boomers. The immigration issue is you would have to have so many people coming in that you almost wouldn't recognize the country. I don't know that you could cram enough people in fast enough to generate enough taxes.
But that's one of the things that's often said, is that we effectively immigration, at least we're not declining population like Japan and Russia are right now. But I think in your book you say that can't be the total solution. It might be a possible solution.
It's not
partial
a negative.
Solution.
It's not a negative.
Not a negative. There's one thing we haven't talked about that we might or might not have a solution to, and that's something called inflation, which is a whole nother tax. If we can look at graphic number 6, I want to show you, and this is just since 1960, so it's not exactly like in a lifetime ago. If you had $1,000 in 1960, you could buy what it takes $6,818 to buy today. And so what the elected officials and non-elected officials, that is the Federal Reserve System, has done to the value of the dollar, Scott, is criminal in itself. You talk about having a trial and taking people out, you could literally take them out here.
I'm not quite sure. What do you mean, literally? I have to be careful how we language.
I understand,
this.
But you know, this is. Did you remember? I don't know. I got out of college in 1964, and I thought to myself, you know, if I ever made $20,000 a year, I mean, if I ever made $20,000 a year, I'm going to be in Fat City. And yet, $20,000 a year is hardly. It's below the poverty level because of inflation.
It would now qualify you for a good number of programs.
It would. It would.
Including, I think, the earned income tax credit.
It probably would. So do you have a solution to the inflation problem at all, or did you guys address that in your book?
Well, we only addressed it as a fear that the if these unfunded liabilities keep increasing, as we roll toward them and they start becoming cash demands, the government will continue fulfilling what people want by printing the money, and then we get into an inflation race.
Yeah. Well, ultimately, do you want to talk about this, George? You can talk about it as well as anybody. The issue of who's going to change all this is not probably going to be our elected officials. It's going to be who?
Well, I think we have to, and it seems to me that it's if we get a chance to make a decision with our buying power, maybe we'll do the right thing. We'll pick the medical benefit that works best for us, and maybe we don't even do it in this country.
Well, in fact, there's a lot of heart surgeries being outsourced to India. It's not just business process outsourcing, is it, George?
No, that's true. India, South Africa, there's a lot of places to go for medical treatment that costs a lot less than it does here if we could find the money to do it because it wasn't tied up in the government.
Interesting. Thank you very much. I want to look at a brief video clip. I interviewed a guy named Pete Peterson about 15 months ago, and for those of you who know Pete Peterson, he wrote a book called Running on Empty, How the Democrats and Republicans Are Ruining America, and he also is the senior chairman of the Blackstone Group, private equity firm, and also is chairman of the Council on Foreign Relations, and I asked him about these kind of issues, and here's what Pete Peterson had to say.
Well, I spoke recently. I was brought up in Nebraska, and I went out to South Dakota, where I hadn't been for a while, because I live in New York, and you get kind of removed from the red state reality that I was brought up in. And it was at the University of South Dakota, and there were a bunch of kids there who were asking that question. I said, you know, I look at you kids, and I remember the old joke about the philosophy class where the professor asks the kids which is worse, ignorance or apathy. And some sleepy kid from the back says, I don't know and I don't care. And I said, that's really part of the problem here. I'm talking about your future, kids. I'm talking about your taxes. And if you have to pay 35 or 40% of pay, your standard of living is going to be affected. If you have to assume these tens of trillions of dollars of debt, then you're going to be paying a lot of money on interest costs. So, baby, this is your future, not mine. I am about as fat and secure as I can be. So part of the problem is how do we get the young people involved here? Because I don't think for a moment the parents and grandparents have suddenly become coldly greedy and indifferent. It's just that the politicians have misled them and they've anesthetized them, you know, to what the real realities are. So somehow we've got to get the public better educated, and your programs are extremely important in that regard, in getting them educated.
And of course, that's what your book is all about too, Scott. Talk to me about a personal level. What can that person do, assuming that they can't influence their elected official to change the madness in Washington? What should they be doing personally to protect themselves in the future?
Saving more, investing more carefully, trying to squeeze out investment expenses. Everybody should be doing that, but it really becomes crucial. Having a tilt in investments toward things that are protected from inflation. By that I mean, you know, substituting Treasury inflation protected securities for regular Treasury securities. That's the most conservative step. Putting some money in foreign bonds or shorter term foreign securities, because those will change. Owning their own home, that's a source of income that isn't taxable. And I think that's going to get to be quite precious. Owning real estate. Now, these are all recommendations that we made in the book, and the book was published in January of 2004. Real estate has had such a run, I'm beginning to wonder, I might pause for 2006.
Well, Governor Wallach of the Federal Reserve Board said a few years ago, he's no longer on the board, but he said inflation is like a country where no one tells the truth. And I'm afraid he's right about that. And one of the issues with home prices, as you know, is something called inflation. And if you buy something with a big debt on it, and inflation is going up and those assets appreciate, then the smaller amount you put in it, the bigger return you have, because you're paying back the debt with cheaper dollars. So there are winners and losers in inflation. It's just that it is a country where nobody tells the truth. And I know you're about to tell the truth, so go for it.
One of the things that we've been talking about is the tax, that we have a potential tax increase for future children and generations. What I haven't heard, although we touched on it briefly, but nobody ever wants to talk about, is the other side of that, and that's decreasing the cost of the Medicare program. And do you want to address that?
Good question.
Well, I talked about it a little bit before, that the only way to decrease the cost is really to change practices. And that's beyond, you know, what I know about. I cited one example where there are interactions where you get the patient engaged in making decisions, and those decisions tend to be more conservative than more aggressive and more expensive treatments. That would save a great deal of money. It wouldn't solve the problem. It would change the coefficient on the equation.
On the other hand, to really get controversial, is Medicare paying for things they shouldn't be paying for?
If you look at the Dartmouth Health Atlas, you can be sure that they are, because medicine presents itself as scientific, but the Dartmouth Wenberg's work there shows that there are wild variations in the intensity of different procedures. All kinds of different procedures may vary by 400% and 500%. You know, for instance, the best place to die at home in the United States is Bend, Oregon. If you want to make sure that you die in an intensive care unit, the better place to live is Newark, New Jersey, or New York City. The costs vary quite a bit. So why do they vary?
I don't know. I'm fairly excited about where I'm going to die, if you don't mind. But thank you, Scott.
There's a quotation attributed to Albert Einstein, which is that he said the most powerful force in the world is that of compounding interest. In your book, you say that if people aren't saving at least 10%, they may be living very dangerously. Isn't it true that particularly for the younger generations, for all the reasons you've said, they're going to lose out on this greatest force of the world if they don't start saving, and saving a lot? Otherwise, they may never get much of the benefit of compounding interest.
I think that is the case, and they clearly aren't going to have the benefit of defined benefit pensions. So to the extent that they don't save much more aggressively than their parents did, they're going to be looking at a shortfall.
And but the problem with these benefit programs, it discourages saving, because as a financial planner, who I think you knew, Alan, back in the old days, said to me years ago, he said, people who don't save for their own retirement are basically saying, I'm going to spend 100% of what I make when I'm working and part of what you made when I'm not working. So there we are.
Scott, if the U.S. population woke up tomorrow morning and realized and accepted everything that's in your book and somehow managed to just run everyone out of Congress and said, Scott, please come to Washington and do what you can with this problem, what would you do?
I'd probably want to leave the country, because
okay, Scott.
I don't envy people in Washington at all. I think we can move toward a privately funded individual account basis with some kind of safety net. We have to have a safety net. This is an important social program, and it would be distasteful to see public starvation. And that could be a real issue. That's the reason we had Social Security in the first place. It was 1935. It was a political choice. If we hadn't had a program like Social Security, there was a real danger of political upheaval.
But you had a situation then where the average lifetime expectancy was less than the 65 years. And I didn't bring it because I couldn't find it. I told you ahead of time, but I have I have a copy of the original Social Security brochure that said you will never pay more than $30 a year and your employer will pay $30 a year. So that was the original brochure, the original promise that was made. I think they've changed that last I checked just a little bit, Scott. Okay, we just have a very short time, Scott. What have you not said to this viewing audience and these folks here in the studio that you want to say?
What I would really like to see is more political activism. I would like to see people ignore both parties. I think both parties have essentially declared themselves illegitimate and acting counter. I'm not a political person, so I don't know how that manifests itself. But I think we need to have a widespread, deep disenchantment with both parties. And we have to realize that both parties are getting us to, by hating the other party, they're distracting us from the real issue, which is that they are making commitments in our name that cannot possibly be fulfilled. And the burden of those commitments and the distress is going to fall on our children.
Unfortunately, I'm afraid you're right. Scott, thanks for being here. You know, a British writer, Alexander Tytler, born in Edinburgh in 1747, made the following observation. He said, "A democracy cannot exist as a permanent form of government. It can only exist until the voters discover that they can vote themselves largesse from the public treasury. From that moment on, the majority always votes for the candidate promising the most benefits from the public treasury, with the result that a democracy always collapses over loose fiscal policy, always followed by a dictatorship. The average age of the world's greatest civilizations," he said, "has been 200 years. Well, we're a few years past that, but the clock is running. Every year I visit with my kids about this problem, and I am personally asking you to contact me if you will get involved in changing the insanity that we have strapped on our future generations. Will you do something? Email me at info@frtv.org or call and leave a message at 214-442-1600. I am, as my friend Elmer Jenkins would say, as serious as a heart attack about this. We are always talking about things that matter with people who care. Now it is the time for people to start doing more than just talking. Thank you.
Want more episodes like this? Don't forget to subscribe and get updates each week for the Free to Choose Media Podcast.